Hey, Johnny, that one was for Donington. Oh, come on, we've got to take these victories anywhere we can get them. Welcome to Bike Live again. Let's go! Yes, this is episode 57 of Bike Live on Motorsport 101. Little inside note for those of you that aren't listening live on Discord. We weren't supposed to be doing this as two separate shows, but here we are.
Hey!
Warm welcome. This is the first time since the move across and since this new format that we've actually had to split Bike Lives. This is the second in the week. As this time, we look back on the World Superbike Supersport and Supersport 300 action that took place last weekend at Assen. The latest round, the fourth round of the World Superbike Championship. As referenced in the intro, Tom Sykes finally getting his first win of the season, breaking Jonathan Rea's streak of victories in Assen, although he did extend that to 8 the day before. We'll talk about all the action from that weekend. Johnny Rea's brilliant victory in the first race, Michael Vandermark coming closer than he's ever come to winning his first World Superbike race, and he did it on home soil as well. And the Kawasaki team double that was completed by Tom Sykes in race 2. And whether the new rules have in fact returned us back to the status quo again of the last few years. We'll also talk about all the craziness of World Supersport as Jules Cluzel finally returned to winning ways, although he was very nearly beaten by a guy who started at the back. And we'll talk all about the final lap seen round the world in World Supersport 300 as no less than 4 race leaders crashed out in the final half lap of the Grand Prix. It was an incredible, incredible race that we'll talk all about a little bit later on. But joining me once again for, well, part 2 of this recording, hour 3 of this recording, but the first part of this second episode, if you get where I'm coming from, is Andre Harrison. Well, welcome, Dre. We've got Superbikes to talk about now.
It's like this is your first double taping. For me, yep. I call it Tuesday. I've been here before. I'm used to it. I eat bubble recordings for breakfast. Let's talk some superbikes.
Yeah, we had a great weekend and a great time. If you didn't listen to episode 56, which we literally finished recording like 10 minutes ago, then do check it out with myself, Dre, and Patrick Hofstetter, who was a brilliant debutant on Bike Live this week, talking all about the Grand Prix of the Americas that took place last weekend. Marc Marquez's 6th victory in a row in the good state of Texas. So we'll talk all about that on episode 56. Do check that out if you haven't already. Places you can find us though, facebook.com/motorsport101, on Twitter we are at motorsport_101. Our YouTube channel is youtube.com/motorsport101 as well. Around a month to go until Day of Classics returns, so keep an eye on that. The month of May, that's coming very soon. Our website is motorsport101.net, and if you back us financially on Patreon at a $5 level, you can earn yourself early access to both of our weekly shows. You can do that at patreon.com/motorsport101. If you back us at a $10 level, you get access to our Discord server, and you can listen to this show live as Henry Chapman is doing at this very second. So good evening to you, Henry.
Attaboy.
You can do that too by backing us at the $10 level on Patreon. So do that if you can. We very much appreciate your support, Dre in particular, who is using the increased support from you guys to upgrade his audio equipment.
Last show I'll have to record with my mediocre equipment. Like, I ordered it today on Amazon. I get a special thanks as well to Tom Brooks, an all-round good egg and MotoGP social media voiceover guy. If you've played Gran Turismo Sport, you've probably heard his voice without even realizing. All-round good egg and was very helpful in picking this stuff out for me. So, Tom, if you're listening, thanks an awful lot, buddy.
Yeah, we need to get him on the show as well at some stage.
We do, good
back
lord.
On the show. With Dawn, we'll give it the okay. Let's get cracking then with the World Superbike action last weekend. And let's start with what happened on Saturday. And a weekend started in kind of unusual circumstances, but the perfect circumstances if your name is Rebecca James. Hope you're listening, Bex. Alex Lowes took his first ever pole on the Saturday. Didn't quite go his way in the race, though. We did have a Yamaha fighting for the win, though, in the form of Michael Vandermark, who was still chasing his first ever win in World Superbikes. And, of course, what would have been a memorable victory on home soil. He didn't quite get it, Dre. A guy called Jonathan Rea saw to that.
I know. Really good at Assen. And
that was 18.
Yeah, eighth consecutive win at Assen, his 12th in his career, which I think ties Carl Fogarty's record for most Assen victories. with 12 in his career. He's phenomenal around here, but what a phenomenal effort from Michael Van der Mark. At Assen, he just comes alive. He really does. It's like he finds an extra half second he doesn't have on any other circuit. He was immense, both race one and two. He was completely unafraid, unintimidated by the elite runners around him in there that turned into a bit of a punch-up, especially in the early going. But he looked right at home at Assen. He could see he was being cheered on by the home fans, and like the fans went potty when he came over the line in second. He hadn't even won the race, and they were just so happy for him. But yeah, it was a phenomenal spectacle. A much-deserved pair of second places. I think it was particularly racy in race one. I think he was fantastic, and he belongs in the front. And I hope Yamaha can give them a little bit more so that he can challenge the wins a bit more consistently, because the guy's a phenomenal talent. When everything comes together, he's so fast. Just not quite today, but again, he lights Assen up, and Assen is better with him being there in the Superbike paddock for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll perhaps talk about more the implications within his team a little bit later on, because it does appear as if the tide is rather turning within that Pati Yamaha squad at the moment. Although Alex Lowes has certainly had the fair share of the bad luck within that team this season. But we'll cover that in a moment. First of all, though, we had to talk about the winner, Jonathan Rea, who qualified second to Alex Lowes on Saturday. And then, as much as you can say it when a guy only wins by just under a second, he kind of controlled it, Dre. I mean, I know he always had guys behind him. He had Van der Mark, Davies, and a fast-closing Sykes behind him at the end of race one. But it just appeared as if Jonathan Rea had that extra 2-3 tenths of a second in his pocket when he needed it. And with about 3 laps to go, he decided to deploy it.
Yeah, the pin got pulled with about 3 front. He knew if there was ever going to be an attack from the rear, it was going to happen then. He delivered. He had an extra couple attempts in reserve, and he deployed it with about 3 laps to go. He got that 1 second advantage, and you know, did what he needed to do to get the win. Michael just didn't have an answer for him at the end. Neither did Chaz Davis, unfortunately. We were denied a tense last lap dogfight, you could say, for the victory. But still, another phenomenal ride from Jonathan Rea. It almost gets boring saying this about just how fantastic he can be when he's at his best. He's untouchable. And then again, he never looked like he wasn't going to win that race. He looked like he had a little bit more compared to everybody else in the field. He delivered in the clutch when it mattered most.
Yeah, he did. And again, it just emphasises just what an incredible rider this guy is, and just how he thinks his way through a race and manages the race. Where, you know, he decided when he illustrated this when he spoke to Charlie Hiscott of Eurosport after the race, that he recognised very early on that he couldn't break them, that he couldn't get away. And what he initially wanted to do was just break away and set his own pace and lead by a couple of seconds and have that race under control. But once he realised he couldn't do that, it all became about saving his tyre, making sure he had some tyre left at the end of the race for that one big push towards the end where he could finally break them and win the race. And that's essentially what he did. And it was pretty clear that Van der Mark was having to use more of his tyre to stay with him, to try and, you know, put that Yamaha where he wanted it and try and win what would have been a memorable race on home soil. And Jonathan Rea just had a bit more in his hand in hand at the end of the race to try and break away. And it comes hot on the heels, Dre, of the first sort of incremental change in the regulations. We were always promised that there would be changes after rounds 3, 6, and 9 of this season, this 13-round season. 3 rounds in, we saw Ducati have their wings clipped to a certain extent. I believe the clarification that we got was that there wasn't necessarily a change in revs, but that all the other manufacturers were allowed upgraded parts or allowed to introduce upgraded parts. But it was noticeable how the Kawasaki suddenly came to the fore and the Ducatis dipped. Was that purely coincidental, or did the regulations have something to do with that?
I'm not sure on this one, because last year, Chaz Davis was on the brink of a dogfight with Jonathan Rea in the race one attempt for the victory, but then of course Chaz Davis's engine blew up on the final lap of that race. So Ducati have taken a step back compared to last year, at least on the same circuit and in similar conditions. At least, I mean, again, as you said, they were allowed upgrade. Everyone else was allowed a certain, you know, new amount of upgrades, and they were also given 250 revs back. The rev limit was increased for every manufacturer except for Ducati. They were given 250 RPM back. So I don't think 250 revs was the difference maker that suddenly made Kawasaki fundamentally better than Ducati this weekend. I think there's a bit more to it than that, but I think Dorna needs to be a little bit careful here. They're playing with fire when it comes to changing these rev limits around so much, because I don't think this is an exact science, and they risk getting it very wrong.
Yeah, I think it's difficult to be so reactive to results when some circuits are going to suit some bikes more than others. I mean, it's clear from history that this circuit has always favoured Johnny Rae. He's, as we mentioned, his race one victory was his eighth in succession around Assen. All of which, of course, have come on... seven of those have come on Kawasaki's, and the first of those was on a Honda back in 2014. But the fear I have with this, and this kind of hits on your point, is that Kawasaki might find themselves getting the wings clipped in three rounds' time, because we've seen them win both races at Assen. We don't know what's going to happen at Imola, but then Donington's next, which is quite likely going to be a Tom Sykes double weekend. And then what happens then? Do Kawasaki get dragged back again because they won four out of six?
Yeah, like it's. I've said this from day one. I wasn't sure that clipping people's revs was the right idea from the start, and I think we're starting to see the problems of changing rev limits and whatnot, because they turned. It looks like they've turned Assen from a weekend where anybody could win into a weekend where Kawasaki won both races comfortably in the end, especially in race two.
Yeah, got a 1-2.
Yeah, exactly. A 1-2 in the second race. So all of a sudden, it's like you've just given Kawasaki a gift by giving them an upgrade before Assen. So they need to be careful. And as you said, like Imola is up next, I think, right? And Imola is a Chaz Davis circuit. With the limits that are now in place, is Kawasaki going to be more competitive now in Imola? Like they're going to have to be careful here. Because if by hook or by crook, if Rae or Sykes is a threat in Imola, and then as you said, like Donington is after that, which is the Tom Sykes round on the calendar. What are you going to do after round six? Are you going to take another 250 revs off Kawasaki to try and balance the field again? It's not an exact science, and this is problematic. I said from the start that I don't think the racing was questionable enough to justify such radical changes, and I'm starting to see cracks appear in this. In this system that Dorna's employing, where they're so stringent on trying to balance the field.
They're going to have to be careful, because as we mentioned, some circuits are just going to play into the hands of some bikes more than others. And as we mentioned, Assen has always been a particularly friendly circuit to Jonathan Rae and Kawasaki. And Jonathan Rae has now got himself into a position, Dre, where with that second place in race two, which obviously wasn't what he was going for, even though he came from ninth on the grid, but he did finish quite a long way clear of Chaz Davies, who was only fifth. We'll talk about Chaz's weekend in a moment. But Jonathan Rae, from what looked like a very, very close championship battle, and we said as much after Aragon, we thought we got a real championship on, Johnny Rae suddenly eked out a 30-point lead again.
Guys, it might be over.
Yeah.
I'm not even exaggerating. You can't give Jonathan Rae a race in hand. That's too big an advantage. He doesn't make those sorts of mistakes. So I'd be like... But that's the thing. Jonathan Rae doesn't have rider errors. He's been very like the issues he's had has come through stuff that wasn't his fault, and I think that's happened pretty much the entire time in this dominant era of Rae for the last three and a bit years now, where it's been the bike that's let him down on occasion, but he doesn't make mistakes. And all of a sudden, him having a 30-point lead again, and Rae taking 45 points out of Assen's weekend again, a lot more than anybody else in the field. Is a problem. It's a big problem. And again, as you said, like Rae goes well at Donington, like he's probably going to be gunning for a pair of seconds at Assen, and sorry, at Imola, I should say, and 40 points out of Imola would be fine. Like he can afford to give up 10 points to Chaz Davies if assuming Chaz takes a double. That's doable. That's very doable, given that Rae seems to have the advantage over Tom Sykes again for the most part. So yeah, like there's a lot of positive reasons for Jonathan Rae going into Imola next weekend. It's coming up roses for him. This was a fantastic weekend for his title, to get his title campaign back on track, and all of a sudden he's looking in a very comfortable position again.
Yeah, he is. He's looking very, very good Indeed, and yeah, Chaz Davies is almost going to need to, not, he's going to have to double Imola, but he's going to need the likes of Melandri, Forres, Rinaldi to all get in there, isn't he? And try and upset Kawasaki. But we'll talk about Davies in a moment. Let's cover race two then. And the first win of the year for Tom Sykes, who, depending on who you believe, has had either a poor or an unlucky start to the season. he was keen to stress the latter after his win on Sunday, and that things just didn't go his way in Thailand, and he chose the wrong tyre in Aragon, and so on. But whoever you believe, Dre, whichever camp you're in, whether you think he's had a good start to the season or a bad one, he needed that victory badly, didn't he?
He did. He did. Just to steady the ship a little bit, because Sykes had just struggled with results.
Especially
like
from race two pole, he had to convert that.
Yes, and like the only annoying thing about race two was because of the way the grids are calibrated, because of the reverse grid rule, which is quite seemingly becoming more redundant by the race now, because they gifted Tom Sykes race two. And there's no disrespect to Tom Sykes, but with all your other major runners starting on the back of row two or early row three in this case, Sykes's race pace was as good as anyone in the leading field. The advantage of starting race two from pole compared to, you know, seventh if you finish in third, compared to starting from pole by finishing fourth, it's too big a difference now, because you gave Sykes a clear run and clear air off the grid from pole in race two. It was too big an advantage. Everybody else was fighting to get through the field, and by that point, the race was already over, because Sykes had a similar level of race pace to everybody else in the field and the massive advantage of starting the race from pole position, and that was it. It was over. And you know, if you're so insistent on trying to balance the field, why have you got reverse grids now? Just throwing it out there.
Yeah, it is a good question worth asking. And I think, yeah, the race two pole was certainly a very powerful tool for Tom Sykes. As you mentioned, he did have race-winning potential pace anyway. I think it was a bit of a perfect storm in one respect, in that there happened to be four guys with race winning pace, and obviously only three of them could get on the podium. So whichever of those four didn't get on the podium was always going to be at a huge advantage in race two. It just happened to be Sykes that was the fourth man in race one that happened to have that pole position. And whatever the advantage he had to convert that, as I say. And I tweeted real time on that first lap. I tweeted, "Clear off, Tom." Because I was like, you've got to exploit this, because it's clear you've got the same sort of pace as these guys. If you can get yourself a second to 2 seconds immediately right out of the gate around a place like Aston, that's going to be very hard to pull back, however good you are. And Tom Sykes clearly recognised that he had to get out front early and just gap them immediately, whatever it cost, no matter how much he took out of his tyre. And that was the real sort of factor that Johnny Ray said afterwards, that he was still clinging on to, even when he got up to second and he was 5 seconds behind. He was just clinging on to hope that Tom Sykes had ruined his tyre by building up that lead, but it just turned out he hadn't. He just had that clear track, and Johnny Ray, of course, didn't by getting up to second. And in many ways, Dre, Shaky Byrne touched on this after race two, so I'm going to bring it up now. It kind of hits on one of the frustrations within Tom Sykes, and I can tell you from experience, one of the frustrations of being a fan of his, in that it's very, very clear that in clear track, with empty tarmac ahead of him, on his own, Tom Sykes has bordering on unrivaled pace. But it's clear that when you put him in a pack with riders ahead of him, he can't overtake them. And that's clearly going to be... That until he gets over that hurdle, he's never going to be a match for Johnny Ray, is he?
No. I think Shaky was absolutely, you know, nail on the head. I'm talking about after race two and talking about Tom Sykes.
Shaky Byrne said if he'd have taken third in yesterday's race, or if he'd won race one, there's no way he was going to win race two from ninth on the grid.
No chance. And Shaky was spot on. Like, he can't overtake. He hasn't got that extra half a tenth or that extra 5 yards under braking.
Just that aggression.
The extra level of aggression that Jonathan Ray was so masterful at last year. Like, that was the one Jonathan Ray the title last year, is that he was so unbelievable from starting from 8th or 9th place to win race two from 9th on the grid. He's having a harder time of doing that now this year. He's not won a race two so far this season, Jonathan Ray. But like the way it's going right now in the field, like last year was the walking example. Jonathan Ray was bullying his way to the front. They would have been 2 or 3 laps. Tom Sykes was always taking, you know, 5, 6, 7, maybe half the race before he could get into a position that relative to the ability of him and his bike. You give Sykes clear air, he's absolutely fantastic. He's almost impossible to beat. You put him in a pack, he's not winning it. It's as simple as that, because other people, like, I'd say Ray, Davis, and Vandermark in particular, have that extra level of aggression that they can make a they can make a lunge or they can make a aggressive move stick that Tom Sykes just doesn't seem to have the extra cojones to do for some reason. And it's hurting. It's hurting badly in these championship campaigns. It's probably the biggest difference maker between him and Jonathan Ray is that Ray has a level of aggression combined with almost unparalleled speed.
Yeah, what Tom Sykes has got to hope, I suppose, is that just the pure confidence he gets from winning this race will enable him to kick on. I mean, it was noticeable to me how emotional he was after winning that race in race two. Given that, even though that it was a race two, given that he'd taken full advantage of the reverse grid pole. And as you mentioned, separate point, but you mentioned that whether the race two reverse grid is redundant now. I'm pretty certain, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's the first time a race two pole man's won, isn't it, since these new rules have come in?
I'm pretty sure that's the first time
someone has won from race two pole, and that was just an instance where the fastest bike in the field somehow happened to be on race two pole, which isn't really what the format is designed for. So again, that is on the point as to whether, you know, if this is the first time it's actually been converted into a win.
I just double checked last season's results. Yeah, Henry's 100% right as well. That's the first time a race two pole sitter has converted it to a victory.
That again hits on just how useful and how powerful that is actually being at the moment. But yeah, as I say, Tom Sykes, he needs to take some confidence from this, and the emotion that came out of him just emphasised how much this meant to him. He's had some domestic issues, it appears, over the winter back at home, which obviously affected him. And you know, he was unwell for a lot of last year, so you know he's not without his problems. He still needs to try and find this consistent level. And again, it's the source of the frustration. This is how good he can be. He's not a world champion for no reason. So it's just a case of if he can find this more regularly, because if he can, who knows what he can achieve, and who knows how close a run he can give Jonathan Ray over the course of a season. Just unfortunately, the way his season has started, he's given him 58 points up for grabs. He's given him 58 points of an advantage already that no matter how good Tom Sykes is for the rest of this year, he can probably forget winning this year's world title. Unfortunately, that already looks like it's going to go to either Jonathan Ray or Chaz Davies. And let's talk about Chaz then. He's second in the championship at the moment, but a third and a fifth for Chaz from the weekend at Assen. Third in race one when he was legitimately in the fight for the win, so he wasn't exactly uncompetitive there. But apparent tyre problems caused him to fade in race two and finish a very lonely fifth. But it's got to be a source of concern, Dre, that Ducati were legitimately the third fastest bike at Assen.
Indeed. Yeah, and I think Alex Lowes would have played more of a factor, especially in race one, if they actually correct tyre on his bike on the grid. Yamaha, what were you doing? I think you're completely right. I think Michael Vandermark is clearly the biggest threat to the Kawasaki's in both races. Again, Vandermark was within breathing distance of Jonathan Ray on both races. You can't ask for much more than that from Vandermark in a field, in a situation where those Kawasaki's are so broken and so consistent in the superbike field, and Yamaha they only tend to really be competitive maybe once or twice a season, like we saw last year here, and maybe at Misano might be the other occasion where maybe Philip Arden, where we had Yamahas in the contention for wins and it didn't seem like it was some sort of fluke. It must be a concern that, you know, a week after the regulations change, or they give Kawasaki and everybody else a little bit like Dorna realize that, oh yeah, Ducati seems to be the best all-rounder in the field right now. Let's peg him in a little bit here. And one round later, it's had the complete inverse effect. Ducati, who, as we said, were much stronger here last year, especially in the case of Chaz. Then Chaz goes home with a third and a fifth. Marco Melandri a sixth and a seventh. They just weren't there this weekend. They were legitimately behind the Yamahas in terms of pure pace. And yeah, just a bit of an eyebrow raiser for Chaz, who's now all of a sudden staring at a 30-point deficit.
Yeah, a bit of a worry for Chaz. He's 30 points behind. Marco Melandri's even further behind now. He's 44 behind Jonathan Rea. And I hate to say this because we love Marco Melandri. He's a legend of the sport in the last 10-15 years, both in the World's GP paddock and in this paddock. But if you take his double out of the equation in Phillip Island, he's gone 8th, 7th, 4th, 3rd, 6th and 7th. And he's been beaten by Chevy Forres in a number of those races as well. Was beaten by Forres in both races at Assen. I hate to say it, but it's looking more and more like that double in Phillip Island was something of a flash in the pan for Marco.
Indeed, one podium finish since then, only two out of his last six in the top five, which, given the bike he's on, given that, you know, Chaz Davis again has had, you know, six podium finishes out of the first eight races.
Torres beat him on the MV this weekend.
Yeah, that's not a good sign. Jordi Torres was in race two, but it's a shame. It's like I have to ask, like, the question I have to ask is, like, it looks like the Ducati baseline this year is a lot higher than it was last year. I think last year a lot of it was down to Chaz often overriding that Ducati in desperation to give Jonathan Rea a fight. This year, I think Xavi Forres has been the X factor. Xavi's pace, I think, has proven that Ducati has got a much better bike this year overall compared to where it was last year, because they've now got two front gunners by the looks of it. Like, Xavi Forres has only finished one race outside of the top five this season and has 100 points through the first eight rounds. He's only 15 behind Melandri in the championship, and this is with the fact that Melandri got almost half his points out of the opening weekend.
Yeah, and since Phillip Island, Forres has beaten Melandri four out of the six races since.
So it looks like, by all accounts, Melandri is trending below the curve. And yeah, that's not a good sign. And I think if he keeps up, he's going to end up slipping to Xavi and probably Tom Sykes in the championship standings as the race goes on, as the season goes on. It's a shame because, again I think Marco is clearly capable of better than this. I don't know if how much of that is the problems with the shakes that his bike seems to have developed this year as well, which we still saw a bit of that Assen as well again, which is just alarming that he's the only guy in the field whose bike seems to act like that. It's very bizarre. But yeah, it's just that double win in Australia might have been fool's gold for Marco to a degree.
Yeah, it's looking like that, isn't it? And we've mentioned Forres, who, as I mentioned, has now beaten Melandri in four out of the six races we've seen since Phillip Island. And he might well have beaten him in one of the other two in Aragon had he not fallen off whilst leading the race in that one as well. But all in all, it's still a positive season for Xavi Forres. He's finished fifth and fourth at Assen, which isn't quite the same heights of the first three rounds, where he had a podium at each of the three rounds prior to that, and he'll no doubt have been targeted the same. But we shouldn't overlook the fact, Dre, even though Ducati had a poor weekend, that Xavi Forres was the first Ducati homing race too.
He was indeed. I think that might be the first time that's happened since the first race in Thailand. Again, enough this guy's continued improvement. Again, this is a guy that has had the capability and the potential to get this type of field, but he's doing it on a regular basis now. Like, if Xavi keeps it upright, he's finishing in the top five. And now, remember, that one DNF was a race he very well could have won. So it's Xavi Forres is right up there in the title fight for me, or at least in the fight for third, which is very close between him, Sykes, Vandermark and Melandri, only 15 points covering third through sixth in the title standings, as eight races in. So Xavi is up there, and like, he is now an elite rider in the field for me, like alongside, you know, Sykes, Rea, Davies, and to a lesser degree, maybe Vandermark as well. Like, he is the best of the rest out of the bona fide big two, I would argue. So yeah, Xavi is doing a tremendous job, and having a second gunner for Ducati, but not the guy you're probably expecting, is very nice to see.
Yeah, brilliant weekend. Just to add to a brilliant season for Forres. But let's talk Yamaha, and let's talk about the differing fortunes for their two riders. Michael Vandermark, who had a brilliant double podium at his home round, second and so nearly a win in race one, and then through from the third row to finish third in race two, whereas his teammate took his first ever pole on the Saturday, and then
just promptly had misfortune after misfortune after that. As Dre alluded to a moment ago, the wrong tyre was fitted to his bike for race one. Basically, he chose one compound, and I believe it was his front tyre was a completely different compound than he'd actually requested, which is bizarre how that kind of thing can happen in a world championship race. I just don't understand that at all.
Baffling.
So he finished down in 12th and then crashed in race 2 and finished down in 14th. To explain what happened in race 1, he had engine fears with his first bike, so they rushed out his second bike. And obviously in the rush to fit the, to get his second bike ready, they fitted the wrong front tyre. And that was what cost him in the end. First of all, before we talk about the differing fortunes of their riders, Dre, we mentioned the fact that the Yamaha were the second fastest bike from Ducati's point of view and how it affects them. But let's talk Yamaha and how it affects them, because for them to make the progress they've made since the first round in Phillip Island, where they were underwhelming from where we thought they'd be, to be leaving Assen, all right, it's only Assen, but to be the second fastest team, second fastest bike at Assen, is a measure of their progress.
Yeah, I mean, Vandermark has 3 podium finishes already. Thailand in race 2. This Yamaha team has definitely improved. I mean, they are still probably, outside of maybe Xavi Flores and the rules regarding satellite teams getting bigger concessions, they've been the biggest gainers of the new system. And we kind of predicted that to a degree. But Vandermark is right in there now with Davis and Melandri in terms of, you know, championship position and whatnot. And Vandermark is in the top 5 a lot more frequently. He's had 3 podiums this year. And again, I know Assen... I know Assen is a signature round for Vandermark, and he always seems to find a little bit more around there, regardless of what bike he's on. He's still doing a very good job. He's been very consistent. He's finished every single race this year in the top 10, and he's been in the top 5 for the last 5 races on the bounce. So he's doing a very good job, and like he looks like he's broken off from Lowe's after this weekend, which is a bit of a shame because that's not totally on Lowe's. That's not totally Lowe's fault, especially for race 1. Race 2 was a bit of a classic Lowe's, unfortunately. But sorry, Max. But race one was certainly not his fault, and very unfortunate in that regard that he missed out. But yeah, as you said, like, they have definitely gained from this, from the new rules and the new regulations. They've been given a bit more, and they've taken it with both hands, and they're doing a very, very good job.
And how worried should Alex Lowe's be by this apparent turn in fortunes at Yamaha? I mean, Lowe's was the stronger rider last year, not by much, but he was a stronger rider. He finished ahead of Vandermark in the championship. But from his brilliant pole position, obviously it didn't really go his way, and you can't really argue any of that was his fault. But Vandermark has now jumped a long way clear of him in the championship. Vandermark now on 103 points. He's 27 clear of Alex Lowe's in the championship, and we know that those two riders are going to be very keen to win that inter-team battle come the end of the season. Alex Lowe says, I know how fast I am, and that, you know, his results weren't necessarily reflective of his performance, but that gap in points between him and his teammate will be a little bit longer and a little bit bigger than he perhaps would want.
27 is a lot, especially when you're fighting for points compared to the top, where the gaps get smaller between positions and points given out. So 27 is actually a bit more significant than it looks on paper. You're right. I mean, I think on paper, those two are very evenly matched. They're often together on track. They often battle against each other. We saw at Aragon, they beat the crap out of each other during that race, trying to get one of them. Those two are very competitive. They seem to have a lot of respect for each other on track. But they certainly fight very hard out there. And there is clearly a bit of inter-team rivalry. I mean, again, Alex, a bit of a chip on his shoulder, given his... shall we say, not so favourable time with Suzuki in the past in World Superbikes and his struggles there. Vandermark, you know, was, you know, his Honda time was difficult outside of Assen. You know, again, he had something to prove with Gintoli alongside him as a teammate back in the past. And, you know, he was given a big chance. He was given the seat over Josh Brooks to be in this Yamaha team in the first place, who probably knew that R1 better than anyone on the planet at that point in time, and they knocked back Brooks so they could bring him in. And you know, he's justified it so far. That's still a very, very good team at the bottom. That Yamaha team was very consistent, and you know, two guys on a very good level. They don't, you know, they don't make an awful lot of mistakes, and they're pretty quick. So the Yamaha dynamic is always interesting. They're just not quite where they want to be. I think they still need another two or three attempts where they can really start putting pressure on Ducati and Kawasaki consistently. But it is always very eye-opening to see the inter-team fights between the Yamaha and the dynamic there. 27 points is about as big a gap as those two have had competing against each other since they started out. So yeah, definitely one to keep an eye on.
It is. Alex Lowes will no doubt hope that he can bounce back and redress that balance in Imola for the next round of the championship, which is coming up very, very soon. Yamaha as a whole, though, will no doubt leave Assen very, very happy with their weekend to take two podiums and their first, I think it's their first outright pole position since mm-hmm. returning to the series with this new R1 as well. And, you know, you can engineer yourself onto pole in race two, but pole in race one is determined on outright pace and pace alone. And Yamaha were the fastest boys out there on Saturday in Super Pole, and Alex Lowes taking that pole position is some result. And Vandermark actually set the fastest lap in race one as well. So that bike was genuinely fast in both mm-hmm. the hands of Vandermark and Lowes. So a good weekend of progress for Yamaha. One manufacturer who also had a good weekend that perhaps doesn't get mentioned much are MV Agusta, who had a 9th place finish with Jordi Torres in race one. But their result in race two is one of the standout results, not just of the weekend, but arguably of the season, Dre. For Jordi Torres, our favourite Spanish Elvis, to come through in race two, finish 6th and beat Marco Melandri to the flag in a straight fight. That takes some doing.
That's a phenomenal job from Jordi. Ouch, that's probably the best bike in the field. I know we talked about Melandri being a bit below that bike's full potential at the moment, but that's still a phenomenal result. I mean, okay, Jordi Torres is not going to be Leon Camilla for year one on that bike, and we've been critical of MV Agusta's true ability in the past, and they just don't have the resources that a lot of the big factories do. But Torres, in the races he's been in the top 10, you know, 5 times, and a 6th place on that bike is a phenomenal effort. And they're probably only going to be a bigger gap as these factories spend more and more and try and be more meticulous with these restrictions that the series is now putting upon them. Again, phenomenal job from Jordi Torres. He's done the Lord's work to get ahead of the Ducati there. 6th place is a terrific result.
Yeah, another result worthy of mentioning is the 7th place for Loris Baz. As well, that we saw in race one. That was BMW's best of the season so far. He backed that up with an 8th in race two, even though he'd started 4th on the grid for that second race. He still finished in a solid 8th position. That's the best BMW have looked this season. The other manufacturers, though, had poor weekends by comparison. Aprilia really didn't. They kind of flattered to deceive, didn't they, Dre, with Savadori's 4th place on the grid in Super Pole. They never really built on that. Savadori finishing race one all the way down in 15th behind teammate Giuliano, who was 13th, and then they finished together in 10th and 11th in race two, some 24 seconds off the winner. But we have to mention Honda as well, who are having a rotten time of it at the moment, as if last season wasn't unlucky enough for them. They lost Leon Camilla to that sickening injury that he suffered last time out in Aragon. And then they lost Jake Gagne before Friday practice had even finished, and that was another scary crash.
Yeah, another massive high slide that Jake had taken on that one. I think it was concussion-like symptoms that pulled Jake out from the weekend in the end. And if it's a concussion, I am absolutely glad that Honda did the right thing and immediately yanked him out of the weekend, because we've talked about concussions before. Danilo Petrucci, second impact syndrome is definitely a thing, and it can be fatal in the wrong circumstances. So I am very glad, if anything else, that Honda did the right thing and removed Jake from the seat for the weekend. They did the right thing, even to the detriment of their own team's performance. I'm glad that rider safety was given top priority here. But that is just wretched luck for Honda. They only ran the one bike this weekend, thinking that Camille will probably be back for Imola. So they're just going to run the one bike this weekend with Jake, and again, he picks up a double DNS, did not start. So yeah, Honda take absolutely nothing away from Assen with just the one bike at all. So it's a wretched weekend for Honda, just horrific luck by all accounts. And hope again, wish them both a speedy recovery and hope they're both on the grid for Imola.
Yeah, real shame for them. And it's, as I mentioned on last week's episode of Bike Live, which was two episodes now again, as we talked to you, was that this is kind of their home round because it's the Tenkate team that runs the Red Bull Honda World Superbike team, and Tenkate, of course, are a Dutch company, a Dutch tuning company. So it's as close as they're going to get to a home round at Red Bull Honda. So for them not to even get a bike onto the grid for either race is a real shame for them, and through no fault of their own, both of their riders out through injury. Let's run you through the results then from the Assen World Superbike round. Then Johnny Rae, the winner in race one, taking it by 0.9 of a second in the end from Michael van der Mark. Chaz Davies in third, just ahead of Tom Sykes. Chevy Forest, best of the rest, in fifth, with Melandri in sixth. Loris Baz in seventh. Tati Mercado, eighth on the Oralat Kawasaki. Jordi Torres, ninth on the MV Agusta. And Toprak Razgatioglu, 10th for Kawasaki on the Pochetti bike. Roman Ramos in 11th. Alex Lowes, who had the wrong front tyre on, as we mentioned, down to 12th. Giuliano, 13th on the first of the Aprilias. PJ Jacobson, the one Honda that did race last weekend, for Triple M in 14th. And Lorenzo Savadori in 15th position on the second of the Aprilias takes the final point. Race 2 went to Sykes from pole. 5.5 seconds clear of Jonathan Rae in second. That's the first Kawasaki 1-2 and the first 1-2 for any team this year. Michael van der Mark in third ahead of Forres and Davies. Torres in sixth ahead of Melandri. Baz took eighth ahead of Razgatioglu and Savadori, with Giuliano next up in 11th. Michael Rubin Rinaldi, who's only really sort of headline-grabbing incident for the weekend was how he bolted Sykes in Superpole. He took 12th in race 2 ahead of Jacobson. Lowe's only 14th, and Andre Jezek on the Guandolini Yamaha takes the final point in 15th position. Championship standings, Jonathan Rae has taken control of it now. He's 30 clear of Chaz Davies, with Marco Melandri a further 14 points back. Michael van der Mark is up to 4th now on 103 points. He's 56 off the lead, 2 ahead of Tom Sykes, who's climbed up to 5th. Chevy Forres, despite a solid weekend for him, drops a spot to 6th, with Alex Lowes down to 7th now. Razgatioglu's 8th, Baz is 9th, and despite not starting either race in either of the last 3 races, Leon Camier still holds on to a spot in the overall top 10. It sounds like we're running on rather quickly on this show. It's because we're both desperate to talk about these super sport races, so we'll do that in a moment.
Yes.
Back with us on Bike Live. Let's talk Super Sport, because the Super Sport 600 and Super Sport 300 classes arguably produced the best two races of the entire weekend anywhere on two wheels last weekend. So let's start with the World Super Sport class, the 600cc class. And in many ways, as we have for the last few rounds, I kind of want to start by talking about Kenan Sofoglu, who remains the topic of conversation. I don't know about you, Jay. Did you see his interview with Eurosport on the Saturday?
I didn't, unfortunately. No. And I know, shout out to a good friend of mine, looking spiffy, told me, begged me to watch it, and I never got around to finding it.
Yeah,
God damn me.
What a lovely guy. What a just. It was in some ways it was difficult to watch because you could see how much he wants to keep racing, and he basically said as much without actually saying the words that he's pretty much going to retire. He says he has to think about the rest of his life and think about his health and think about his family. Mm-hmm. And all that sort of stuff, and just how well the guy spoke. And you could see him getting almost kind of emotional when Shaky Byrne was stood next to him and tapping him on the shoulder and saying, you know, me and James Whitten, who is a former World Supersport rider himself, let's not forget. Shaky was saying, you know, me and Whit were talking in the hotel last night, and we both think you're the best World Supersport rider of all time. And you could see how much that meant to Keenan, who, despite having won all the championships, still almost seemed a little taken aback how highly Shaky Byrne, a British Superbike champion, thought of him. And it was really nice to see him. We were expecting before we talked to you next on Bike Live, and there may well be an official announcement on that from Keenan Sofoglu, who looks like he's heading for retirement. In his absence, we got an absolute classic of a World Supersport race, one of the races of the year, and I can say that even without knowing what's going to happen in the next 6 or 7 months, this will be one of the races we'll talk about in November at the end of the season as one of the races of 2018. A brilliant, brilliant race. And we'll talk about the winner in a moment, Dre, but we have to talk about the chronology of this and how this became an incredible race. And it all started with Randy Krumenacker, who, I still can't believe I'm saying this, the actual reason he was starting at the back of the grid, it's amateurish, I cannot believe this. They sent him to the grid, this team sent him to the grid without enough fuel in the bike, which I find amazing. He was rolling out a pit lane on the bike, and apparently there are only 5 litres of petrol in it.
How? How did they get that wrong? this is amateur hour. Like, what the hell is that?
I know. like Krumenacker, like, was it was in no mood to like spare his team's blushes afterwards in part of it. He basically showed them up and threw them under the bus. He was like, yeah, we came out of pit lane and there was only 5 litres of fuel in the bike, so we had to put the bike back into the pit lane to refuel it. And make sure we had enough fuel to actually take the start. And obviously, by doing that, he had to start from the formation lap from pit lane, and then race from the back of the grid, 27th on the grid for Randy Krumenacker. But what followed from that? What followed the amateurish conduct of his team, the Even Bros Yamaha team? We said it's one of the races of the season. That performance from Krumenacker, 27th on the grid, to very nearly win it. It was one of the rides of 2018.
Yeah, pencil that in for my Motorsport 101, like Bike Live and Motorsport 101 awards for individual performance of the year, because that was astonishing from Krumenacker. We might have to end the episode Krumenacker'd, basically, after this, because that was absolutely sensational. To come from the back of the field, he was 10th by the end of lap 3.
A long way back, though.
That was still a good 5 or 6 seconds off the leaders, but he just racked up fastest lap after fastest lap after fastest lap. He did not give in. He got to the leading group, fought his way through there. Obviously, he took advantage of the enormous crash of Caracasulo and Stapleford in there as well towards the end, but got up to the leading pack and very nearly won that race. Phenomenal, like a cut above everybody else out there this weekend. Again, it makes his team look even more stupid for screwing that one up, because he had the pace to win that race at a cakewalk. He was the fastest man on track for the vast majority of that race. Could have won it. Maybe you could argue should have won it given the right circumstances, but doesn't take away from an absolutely phenomenal performance from Randy Krumenacker. That was... And that was a sensational bit of riding and the cherry on top for what was an all-time classic.
Yeah, I mean, we have to try and put this into context, whereas like sometimes you see riders come from the back of the grid to do well, and we see it in car racing as well. Remember Lewis Hamilton came from the back of the grid once at Spa, but it was helped by an early safety car. We've seen races red flag that closed the field up. We've seen riders taken out, as you mentioned, a lot of crashes that promote riders up the order. We've seen riders, and perhaps in the past, make up a lot of ground on lap one, which has helped them. Krumenacker was still 18th at the end of lap one, guys. Who ends the first lap of a 18-lap race in 18th position and still puts himself in a position on the final lap where they can win it? That just doesn't happen. It just beggars belief how he was able to do this.
Ludicrous.
Absolutely ludicrous. And yeah, he was smashing lap records as he did it, as he went through the race. Just an incredible, incredible performance from Krumenacker. As Dre mentioned, he was still several seconds off the race leader very early on in that race. At the end of lap one, Krumenacker was down in 18th, and he was 5 seconds off the race leader. That was lap one of the race. And he still had to overtake guys as he was coming through the field to try and clamber his way up the order and try and get a result out of it. And somehow he did it. Trying to follow his way through the race. Yeah, lap one he was 4 seconds back. Lap two, it was up to 4.9. Lap three, 4.6. And that was by going from 12th to 10th. So he overtook two guys, and he was still 3 tenths quicker than the leaders, which is incredible. By lap six, he's still 4.5 seconds off the lead. We're a third of the way through the race, he's still 4.5 seconds back. And then all of a sudden, he starts taking a second lap out of them once he got into clear track. And smashing lap records as he did it. And as Dre mentioned, the only incident that really helped him climb up the order quicker than he would have done was that incident between Caracasulo and Luke Stapleford. And as far as that incident's concerned, Dre, Luke Stapleford was initially given a ride-through penalty for that. And you know, demoted out of the points, all the way out of the points. He was then promoted back into fifth again after the race. And Luke Stapleford maintains to this day, he said on Twitter, "I did not touch him." You know, he maintains there was no contact, which makes me think that Race Direction were a little bit trigger happy in their awarding of a penalty to Stapleford before they'd even seen all the angles of it.
Blood lost. they saw the giant flying Yamaha heading off towards the ground and thought, well, that's got to be Stapleford's fault, hasn't it?
Yeah.
But no, they looked at the footage again, and yes, they did realise that Stapleford did indeed not touch Caracasulo. It was a hard but fair passing attempt from Stapleford. Caracasulo just lost control of the bike, and to be fair, it was an awful-looking accident in real time. I think he's going at a good 140 miles an hour through that complex, and next thing you know, he's on the ground sliding, and his bike's literally 50 feet away from him, which obviously wasn't ideal. But, it turns out Stapleford didn't touch him, and I'm glad the stewards took another look, and they did the right thing in reinstating Stapleford back into that fifth place, because it was a very, very good performance from Stapleford to begin with, and I'm glad he was allowed to keep that fifth place, because... it wasn't his fault, and I'm glad the shoes did the right thing. But, you know, just go easy on by handing out all these. Like, that's a massive penalty to be handing somebody without looking at the footage properly. Like,
yeah, they did it, like that, within two laps of it, didn't they? It wasn't like they waited until after the race. They straight away just slapped him with 25 seconds, which I thought was, you know, it's trigger happy and harsh. And Stapleford was reinstated after the race, after an appeal from his team, and quite rightly too. Through it all came a familiar winner in one respect, because a Yamaha won again. They've won every race this season. But for the first time, Dre, since MagniCore 2016, we can finally sit here and say Jules Dam Cluzel has won a World Supersport race.
Yes!
Boy, are we happy to say that.
Yes! Finally! Cluzel wins!
And for me, for braving out around the outside of Krummenacker through that fast left before the chicane on the final lap, that deserved the victory in itself.
Like, When the chips are down, I don't think anyone in bigger nuts than Jules Cluzel. Like, I do not know how he does this half the time, and he has been so unlucky for the last year and a half. He's been so close to other victories. He's been taken out in other races. He's had an engine block in Thailand last season. Like, he could have had a good five or six of these by now in the last year and a half, and I'm delighted he finally got one. No one in the field was more deserving of a win in the last year and a half than Jules Cluzel. He's such a quality rider, and he was the guy that was in control for the majority of that race. He got the whole shot, led the majority of the running. It was, you know, was under pressure a little bit towards the end, but again, like, Krummenacker was all over him, and he survived that dogfight, and he came through to win it. Brilliant ride from Cluzel under intense pressure from a probably angry red mist had already descended Krummenacker, thinking, how the hell did it come to this?
He rode that final lap perfectly, did Cluzel. He defended where he had to. He took a very deliberately defensive line into the disturbing hairpin at the start of the lap where Krummenacker was so strong. Didn't enable Krummenacker to get past him on the back straight that followed that. And as I mentioned, the stones on this guy through the ramshot corner, which is the effectively the penultimate corner in Assen. For those that know the circuit well, it's that fast left-hander before the chicane. And Krummenacker sticks it up the inside of Cluzel. And Cluzel, rather than letting him through and then thinking, I'll have a go in the chicane, he thinks, nope, I'm going to brave out around the outside here. And hold him up. Like, how does he do that? Sticks it out around the outside, gets into the chicane first, misses a gear on the exit of the chicane. But because Krummenacker was so close behind him, Krummenacker had to go wide and ended up going off onto the curbs, and Cluzel still held on to win. That would have been the most Cluzel thing ever if he'd missed a gear on the exit of the chicane and lost it to Krummenacker
in
the end. But fortunately, Krummenacker was so caught off guard by it, he had to go off the track in the end. And stayed in second. So congratulations to Cluzel. His first victory of the year. His first victory since the end of 2016, because he went winless last year. And it's brought him right into the title shakeup. Krumenacker in second, but we have to talk as well, Dre, about the guy in third, because
so far this season, every single podium spot has gone to a Yamaha rider, but that then was brought to an end at Assen by the Italian Raffaele De Rosa, who finished third on the MV Agusta. I mean, he's been doing the Lord's work for them already, because he led the race in Aragon for them, and was still fighting for the lead when his engine blew up. But he got his just rewards, led at various stages when he was battling with Clouzel, and got that MV Agusta onto the podium, which is the least he deserved.
Yeah, like an MV Agusta, and it doesn't suck. brilliant. Yeah, Raffaele De Rosa, again, as we all, you know, it's bad when, like, Greg Kane tweeted this again, like, earlier in the week, but basically saying that it's looking like they could be taking Yamaha's revs away as well, which is like, oh, just, right. More Dorna-related rev potential limiting shit. because they are trying to bring Yamaha back down to earth for being so good this year. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, maybe it should. But they're trying to bring Yamaha down to super sport. But again, Raffaele De Rosa has done a fantastic job in the MV. And it kind of begs the question, after we had shown that Marias had a big crash of his teammate as well for the Kawasakis.
Yeah.
I don't say this to put down anyone else in the field. But how good is Keelan Sofoglu if he's the only Kawasaki within a country mile of these Yamahas? Like, that is walking proof that maybe we shouldn't be having limits. Maybe we just have not appreciated...
better riders on the bike.
Yeah, maybe we just haven't realised just how phenomenal Keelan Sofoglu is. It's crazy. But, yeah, Raffaele De Rosa, again, brilliant performance. Again, another guy that could have won the race on a different day. Was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And again, deserved that second place. Maybe like deserved the second place if not the win. He was just phenomenal. Very unlucky not to win it.
Almost lost at all of this, given how crazy and how thrilling a race it was. Were two other Yamaha riders. First of all, the championship leader and reigning champion Lucas Mayas, who finished in fourth in the end. Only 0.3 of a second off the win, so he's hardly uncompetitive. Mm-hmm. But a fourth for him. And Sandro Cortesi, who qualified on pole position, having won his first Supersport race last time out in Aragon, finishing down in sixth, which, again, only 1.1 off the win. So, again, hardly uncompetitive. They're both right in the mix in the championship. Mayas leads on 71, a point ahead of Krumenacker, and Cortesi's third on 64. So just 7 points covers the top three. Not exactly great results for either Mayas or Cortesi, but in a race like that, I suppose, Dre, they'll probably just be glad for what they got and keen to move on to Imola.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, that's not a terrible result, but that bog down off the start was cost them big, really, on this one.
Yeah, Cortesi had the pole advantage for all of about 10 yards.
Yeah, just completely bogged down on the launch, and Lucas Mayas just took the whole shot by a good 50 feet by the time they got to turn one. It was really a shame on that one. But, yeah, as you said, like, Cortese's advantage from being on pole was gone, but he was in the leading group. It's not a terrible result. It's not a bad haul of points, and I'm sure they'll move on to Imola, which will be a home round as well, so he's going to be well up for that. I expect him to be up the front again.
Yeah, it's brewing up to be a really, really exciting World Supersport season, this, if it hasn't been already. Here's how the race then finished. At Assen, Jules Clouzel the winner. Thank God, finally a win for Clouzel. First win, actually, it has to be mentioned, first ever win for the new Nerds Racing team, who will never tire of telling you their name. That's what the NRT stands for those that are wondering what it means on the graphics. It's Nerds Racing Team. And Clouzel the winner from Krumenacker, who deserved better. Second for him, one of the best rides we've seen in a long time. Rafa De Rosa third for MV. Mayas fourth. Stapleford, great ride for him on the Triumph once he was reinstated back into fifth. And Cortesi sixth. Nicky Tooley seventh, first at the Hondas. Rob Hartog on home territory eighth. Thomas Gradinger, second of the Nerds riders, ninth. And Loris Cresson, who's riding for the Callio team as teammate to Cortesi, was 10th. Rest of the points went to Hannes Soma of Estonia, Ayrton Badovini, who's the second factory MV rider, Andrew Irwin of British Supersport last year, finally over his injuries and in the points in 13th. Well done to him. Wayne Tessels in 14th. And the Finn, Emily Latti, in 15th position takes the final point. Championship standings then, after four rounds of the season, and we have another 7-8 to go at World Supersport. Mayas leads by 1 point from Krumenacker, 71 over 70. Cortese's third, just 7 off the lead. Cluzel is now just 21 points off the championship lead in fourth, so he's right in contention. He's a point ahead of Caracasulo in fifth. Stapleford sixth, DeRose seventh, Tooley eighth. Carl Smith, who crashed last weekend, is ninth. And Thomas Gradinger, the Austrian, completes the top 10. 11th in the championship is Anthony West, and we have to wish him well because he had a horrendous crash last weekend at Assen when his throttle stuck open, which pitched him into the barriers. He's recovering from the injuries he sustained from there that caused him to miss the race at Assen, and we wish him well. Right, finally then, before we go, we have to talk about this World Supersport 300 race. You've probably all seen this final lap that's been doing the rounds on social media this week, courtesy of Eurosport. If you haven't, find it. It's easy to find. One of the most incredible final laps to a race. I mean, if we think back to last year, Dre, in the World Supersport 300 race we had at Assen, that was chaotic enough. But have you, in all the years you've been watching motorsport on two wheels or four, seen a final lap quite like that?
No. And I've been watching nearly 20 years. Jesus. I've got nothing on this one. That was an incredible, utterly bonkers final lap where I joked about, when I first saw this on Twitter, here's a game we can play. Take a screenshot of the leading group going into the second half of that lap. Take a guess who wins. You'll be wrong. I guarantee you, you'll be wrong, because four different race leaders bottled it and fell in some capacity on the final half a lap. They're going four wide around the section as well. And, oh, Jesus, like the last one going into the final chicane where, guy's on for his home win at Assen. He's literally 300 yards from the flag and his brakes fails. And he has to abandon ship at 120 miles an hour. It is a ridiculous race. It's one of the most ridiculous finishes I've ever seen in a bike race ever. Ridiculous. Utterly, utterly ridiculous. You have to see it to believe it.
Yeah, let's try and paint the picture of what happened on this final lap. Because, I mean, it'd been a brilliant race anyway before that, because we had 11 riders in the leading group fighting at the front. Only 7 of them made it to the flag without going off or turning themselves upside down before then. But here's how it went. Mika Perez was leading the race heading into De Bult, which is, I think it's turn 9 at Assen. It's around about halfway around the final lap, the left-hander. Perez goes down, loses the front. That promotes Tom Edwards, the Australian, into the lead. He, at the very next corner, Mandevane, high-sides it and loses the lead. That takes out what was essentially the de facto new leader, Danny Valle, who would have inherited the lead from him. He can't avoid Edwards' bike, and he trips over it and goes off himself into the gravel. So that's three. That's three gone. The very next corner, the fast right kink, which famously Jorge Lorenzo broke his collarbone at in the wet a few years ago, we see Luca Grunwald make contact with Cohn Muffels, who's the championship leader going into that race, the winner of Aragon on the KTM. They go through the fast left-hander of Ramshuk down towards the final chicane. And all of a sudden, you see Muffles, the young Dutchman on the KTM, go spearing off into the gravel with no brakes. That's because that contact with Grunwald clearly unseated his brake calipers or just severed a brake line or something. He had absolutely no brakes. He spears off into the gravel. Fortunately, he was okay. But a fast, fast crash for him. Through all of that comes Luca Grunwald, the German, on the Freudenberg KTM to take his first World Supersport 300 win. By 600th of a second from Glenn van Stralen, the Dutchman, who finished second here last year as a wild card. This time, he's a regular rider. He inherited second, and Scott DeRue, who now leads the championship, took third. He won this race last year on the Motorsport Kawasaki. He finished third. An absolutely chaotic finish to a brilliant, brilliant Supersport 300 race that, quite frankly, anybody could have won in the end. But in the end, it went to Grunwald. He won it from van Stralen by 600 of a second. Then DeRue in third. Anna Carrasco in fourth. Shout out to her. She finished fourth on the DS Junior Kawasaki. With Valid Khan, another Dutch rider, in fifth. Nikita Kalinin, the Ukrainian, sixth. Dorin Lerero, the South African teammate to Carrasco, was seventh. And that was the rest of the leading group that made it home. Everyone else had to go a rather different route to the flag. Janik, the German, was 8th. He's the teammate to Grunwald. Manuel Gonzalez, who was last year's European Talent Cup champion, he finished 9th. And Maria Herrera, you'll know her from previous Moto3 races, she finished 10th in the end, just ahead of the aforementioned Danny Valle, who had to take that tore through the gravel trap after Edwards crashed in front of him. He ended up 11th over the line. Rest of the points went to Danny Valle, as I mentioned, 11th. Max Kapler, 12th. Ali Rusmiputro, the Indonesian, 13th. Mark Luna Bayem, the Spaniard, in 14th. And Koopman, the latest Dutchman of a long line of them in the field. He finished in 15th position in the end and took the final point. Muffles, Perez and Edwards all failed to finish in the end. We're all classified one lap down, and they could quite easily have won the race in the end. What an incredible finish to that Supersport 300 race it was. What it all means for the championship after two rounds of the season so far. Daru leads it at the moment. He has 36 points, four ahead of Grunwald, who's leapt up to second as a result of his win last weekend. Van Stralen is third on 29. Muffles, with his win and Aragon, is fourth now on 25, just ahead of Carrasco on 23. Kalinin's on 23 as well. Larrero on 17. Perez on 16, as is Valid Khan. And Robert Schottmann is 10th in the championship on 11 points. Next round of all of those classes that we mentioned is at Imola, which has signed a new contract, by the way. It's taking it all the way for another 5 years to 2023. One of the classic World Superbike rounds. That is on May the 12th and 13th. So that is 2 weeks from now. There is actually one other class that I need to tell you about from the Assen weekend, and that was the Superstock 1000 class. All that really needs to be told from that weekend is that Marcus Reiterberger won again, and won by miles. Got it?
Yes.
Good. Right. Good. That brings us to an end of this incredible marathon of double episodes that we brought you here on Bike Live. Huge thank you to all of you that are tuning to both shows. We very much appreciate your input. Huge thank you to Henry, who's still listening in the background on the Discord server. So huge thank you to you.
Good man.
backers on Patreon, and you can do the same. Places you can find us before we go: facebook.com/motorsport101. On Twitter, we are @motorsport_101. The owner of the Motorsport 101 Twitter account hasn't responded to our threats yet. On YouTube, youtube.com/motorsport101. Our website is motorsport101.net. And as mentioned, if you want to earn yourself early access to these shows, either by getting it on our Patreon server or by earning access to Discord, you need to do that by backing us on Patreon. Patreon.com/motorsport101 is the place to do it. Don't know about you, Dre, but I feel absolutely crumb-knackered. So we're going to wrap this up. Huge thank you to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week for episode 58 of Bike Live on Motorsport 101. It's worth pointing out that absolutely nothing's happening this weekend, so we don't quite know what we're doing yet. But whatever happens, we'll figure it out. We'll see you next week.
Take care.